Session number 26581.
Group Captain Eccles, Reel 5. We were talking about this incident when the USS Greer sank a U-boat, and this provoked a speech from Roosevelt. It had been attacked by the U-boat first. But yeah. If you'd like to comment on this, you were saying that this led to, you were there, and yet this incident led to Roosevelt's speech and then to a response from the German leaders. If you'd like to comment on the whole thing a bit more.
Yes, the result of the incident was that President Roosevelt gave one of his regular rodeo broadcasts in which he authorized the US Navy to shoot on sight. This was known as the Rattlesnake Speech, and it had an immediate result on Congress, which had been very isolationist in its attitude towards assisting Britain, although President Roosevelt himself had been very keen to give every assistance he could. Anyway, as a result of this speech, the attitude of Congress changed, and supplies were more forthcoming. As far as Churchill was concerned, this was very good news, and he was delighted. As far as Hitler was concerned, Admiral Dönitz, who was commanding the German Navy, issued instructions to his U-boat commanders so that they should shoot on sight American ships. When Hitler heard of this, he called in Dönitz and told him he was to countermand this order because of developments on the Eastern Front, which Hitler didn't want something in the Atlantic to put to one side in the world's news media. So Dönitz had to do as he was told. The result, therefore, of this incident was that both Roosevelt, Churchill and Hitler were personally involved in the incident.
Which you'd flown above, sir.
Yes.
Now, any other incidents you recall, you know, from any of the missions you flew while you were at in Iceland?
It was the beginning of the Russian convoys. And on one occasion, we were escorting a convoy east of Iceland, which possibly was going to Russia. I don't know where. We never knew the destination of a convoy. And the one escort called me up on the Aldous lamp and gave me a long message, which turned out to be something like, give my love to Greta Goodman's daughter when you get back to Reykjavik. No, at that time it was a routine matter of escorting convoys. There was one occasion when I was escorting a convoy, and to my surprise, a large Royal Navy contingent comprising a battleship and a number of cruisers and escorting destroyers were coming at high speed and went right through the convoy, which was rather unusual. It turned out that, in fact, this was the famous occasion when Churchill was returning from America, and he, on seeing that there was a convoy nearby, ordered the Navy to go through it so that Churchill personally could give the convoy his best wishes. Of course, as far as I was concerned, circling around the convoy, I had no idea what was going on.
What was the? I mean, what was it like? The cold. I don't know. We haven't talked too much about this, but when you were up there, what would you wear?
Well, actually, this was really mostly summertime, and in Iceland, in the summer, on a really good day, you could sunbathe. And Iceland and Greenland really should be named the other way around, because Greenland is the place that's ice all the time, whilst Iceland. The climate is not all that dissimilar from northern Scotland. It's a little bit colder, but not impossibly so. The big difference, of course, is the fact of the enormous amount of daylight in the summer and the very little daylight in the winter. Caldadanis, when we moved in, being a primitive new strip, didn't have much in the way of infrastructure. And consequently, there was a great deal of mud around, and most of the time we wore gumboots simply to walk from one place to another. The aircraft were on hard standings, but the hard standings were in fact not concrete, they were a metal strip. But they, at least for the first few months, they did the job they were required to do. One of the great features of Iceland, particularly when I was there, was the fact that we had some very strong winds. There was one occasion when the average wind strength was something like 90 knots, and the propellers of aircraft were turning round, and aircraft that were anchored down with concrete blocks were being blown about. In fact, on one occasion, I landed in a 90-knot wind, or 90-knot gale, and we only ran about 30 yards before stopping, but the strength of the wind was such that I couldn't turn crosswind to taxi back. Every time I tried, it was like a weathercock and was blown back facing wind again. In the end, we had to get out and put on the external locks on the rudders and tailplane and so on, and get a tractor and tow it away from the beginning of the runway. There was, of course, ice around, and one of the routine activities we started was to carry out ice pack reconnaissance of the Denmark Straits to see exactly where the ice pack had got to, because of the fact that the Denmark Straits were a route later on for the larger convoys going to Russia.
So what would you do? Tell me about the ice pack reconnaissance. Would you do it by photography, or would you...
No, it was a visual reconnaissance, just to see really the position of the where the ice packs had started. On one occasion when I went, it was a little bit fraught because the weather was extremely poor, the cloud base was about 500 feet, and visibility was less than half a mile. And I found that I was flying past an iceberg and the top of it was in the clouds. And this made me rather unhappy as to whether I was going to fly into an iceberg as bad as flying into a mountain. Anyway, we didn't.
Anything else? Any other missions or types of missions you did with 269?
Not that I remember of any particular significance.
So, what? How did you come to? I mean, who were there any key personalities you remember from the squadron? You know, that I mean, other than you know, Joe and King, who you've already mentioned, were there any others that sort of you know, perhaps your flight commander or the squadron leaders?
Well. The flight commander and his co-pilot, who were involved in the capture of the U-570, were both awarded DFCs and became prominent because they were given a lot of coverage in the media.
Do you remember their names?
Squadron leader Thompson and Jack Coleman.
And what was he like, Squadron Leader Thompson? Do you know his first name?
Tommy. Well, he was known as Tommy, of course. I knew him very well, and he was a reserve officer, not a VR, an RAFO officer, and he actually ran a garage in Hull. He was obviously older than most of us and married, but a very congenial person.
And he was a flight commander, although he was a squadron leader, or did the ranks change later?
No, the squadron organisation changed. It had been a three-flight squadron with a wing commander commanding and a squadron leader flying, and then three flight lieutenants commanding each flight. This then changed to two flights, each commanded by a squadron leader. So we had a wing commander and two squadron leaders, and the flight lieutenants were supernumerary.
And who was your wing commander?
A wing commander at that time was a man called Kelly, and he was the most amazing man. Amazing in the sense that anyone would do anything for him. He was a tremendous leader, and yet he didn't conform at all to the theory of what a leader should be. He didn't really lead from the front. He occasionally flew, but not very often. But he had the personality that everyone respected him and would follow anything he said and never question anything he wanted. He remained to me an ideal example of what a leader should be.
Was he approachable as well?
Completely approachable. He was one of us. Actually everyone was approachable in Iceland and Caledonius, because we lived in this small farmhouse mess, which was really a corrugated iron building, and we more or less couldn't avoid each other. There was nowhere else to go.
What was the mess like? Could you describe in a bit more detail? And your accommodation?
Well, the accommodation was in Nissenhuts, adjacent to this building. The building was on the top of a small mound, and it was a fairly small farmhouse building. The main area, the main room, became the bar. In fact, it was more or less the only room we had. One or two side rooms where I was for a while the bar officer, and had one of these rooms to do the accounts and so on. But the main room had a purpose-built bar put in it, and we happened to have an airman on the squadron who had been a scene painter in the film studios in, Shepperton or somewhere before the war. And he painted one or two extremely fine artistic efforts on the walls of the mess. At that time, Jane, who was made a prominent cartoon in the Daily Mirror, was depicted, a magnificent, very famous picture it became, of Jane in her semi-dress with an RAF cap on and so on. Shove Ha'penny was our great activity. There was a Shove Ha'penny ladder and everyone played it. And of course, as I said, there was the singing and so on.
Did you have many casualties during the period? I mean, I know they'd had some before you arrived, but...
Well, yes, we did. We had casualties. Actually, when I arrived at Caledonius, the station commander was a group captain, Dado Langlois, who was a World War I aviator. And he rather upset my line of thought on one occasion just after I arrived, when he was telling me at the bar that as a station commander he had great responsibilities because of the fact that there was a 10% casualty rate, and he always had to wonder who he was going to send next on to be a casualty. I can't tell you the exact figures, but aircraft failing to return or flying into hillsides and so on were part of the routine.
Did it worry you much? I mean, how did you feel about it?
No. It was amazing how detached one was. You were very detached about the war as a whole. You listened to the news and, all right, it was like another team playing somewhere else and you were interested maybe in the result. But you were only interested really in what you were doing from day to day. In fact, life during the war was essentially a case of living from day to day. I never had a diary of any forward bookings of events at all. Everything was done on the spur of the moment.
And what about your food in Iceland? I mean, can you give us a bit of a...
The food was, of course, it was very much of it was processed food, tin food and so on. We did actually have, strangely enough, fresh salmon. We had so much fresh salmon that we used to get it fried for breakfast. And this was because the river that went round the perimeter of the airfield had a lot of salmon, and people would do their fishing by throwing in a hand grenade. Well, there was no shortage of salmon.
Now, anything else about your time with 269, or any other stories that might illustrate your time?
No, most of the activity that I was involved in with 269, in fact, with so many Coastal Command squadrons, was of a very routine nature, in which the biggest problem was the weather. and the lack of navigational aids in Iceland.
What do you mean by that?
Well,
because you'd have the same navigational, or you didn't have any modern ones, do you mean? Or?
Well, we didn't have any navigational aids. The only navigational aid we had was, in fact, a radio station which could give you a bearing sometimes, because we couldn't always raise it. And that was about the only external navigational aid we had. Later on, when we got radar, it began to give us a little bit of information about the coastline, if you, how far away it was when you were returning to base, but that was pretty vague. And our navigation was entirely based on dead reckoning navigation, which meant flying a course, a compass course. And in that part of the world, the magnetic North Pole is not all that far away from Iceland. The result was that there was a great amount of what is called declination of the compass needle pointing downwards towards the source of the magnetic pole. This was counterbalanced in a compass by putting balance weights in. And the balance weights kept the compass level, the compass needle level. But it meant, too, that if you were flying east and west, the balance weights were in such a position that the slightest acceleration or deceleration of the aircraft would make the compass needle swing wildly. And it was therefore extremely difficult to fly a steady course. The lack of adequate weather forecasting also meant that a lot of the met winds that we were given turned out to be quite inaccurate. So any navigation that was based on met winds and flying compass courses could lead to very large errors. In fact, it was my normal practice to arrange on returning to base to make a landfall 50 miles east of Caldadanus, with the idea that when we hit the coast, at least we knew where to turn left, and we get eventually to the airfield by following the coastline.
Now, that leads us on quite well to the next thing, because you went on to meteorological flight, didn't you?
Yes, yeah.
Now, tell me how that happened. Had you finished your tour of duty?
No. At about the time I was promoted to flight lieutenant...
Did that involve an exam or...
No, it was a time affair, which was in September of 41, 2 years after I was commissioned. I was in November of that year posted to form and command 1407 Met flight at Reykjavik. Now, Reykjavik airfield had just been completed and had only just come into service use. I didn't know the first thing about what was required of a Met flight. By this time I was 22 years old. And I went off to the UK and spoke to the senior Met officer in the Air Ministry to be briefed on what the Met flights were all about.
Do you remember what he told you, or what they told you?
Well, it was quite complicated. The main purpose of the long-range Met flights was to obtain weather information from the Atlantic so as to give the RAF in the UK better weather forecasting facilities, which in turn meant that Bomber Command could get better weather forecasts for operations over Germany. The information required consisted of temperatures, wet and dry bulb temperatures, and pressures, barometric pressures. And the flight requirement was to fly out in a straight line for, say, 500 miles at 1,000 feet, and every 50 miles descending to 50 feet to get the surface temperature and pressure. At the end of the 500 miles, we climbed in a square, a one-mile square, to a height of 500 millibars, levelling off every 50 millibars, I think it was, to get the wet and dry bulb readings. And then when we got to the top of the climb at 500 millibars, we then returned under our own steam, descending as and when we wanted.
Now, tell me about the equipment you had to get accurate readings.
I'll go back first of all to what was started from the briefing in the Air Ministry. After being briefed in the Air Ministry, I realised that the Hudson aircraft that we were to operate would require certain modifications. I also realised that in order to do the task better and get the necessary range, the aircraft would have to be modified for that reason. So three aircraft had been allotted to the flight formation, and I stated the operational requirements for this aircraft to Coastal Command, which were to devise a thing called a psychrometer strut, psychrometer, psychrometer, a psychrometer strut, on which was attached the wet and dry bulb thermometers. Now, we had to have these outside the aircraft, of course, but to keep the wet bulb wet, we had to have a little water reservoir built and a pump to pump the water through from the reservoir into the wet bulb area. So this had to be invented because we were the first Hudsons to do Met reconnaissance flights. I also said I wanted radar to be fitted because the ASV was just coming out and it was necessary for us to have this radar as a navigational aid. I also asked for the gun turrets to be removed, as we wouldn't require the gun turrets, and to have extra fuel tanks put in so that we could get the extra range. It was, of course, a recognition that in addition to doing the Met flights, we would carry depth charges so that if we came across a U-boat, we were in a position to attack it. The result of this requirement was that, this was in November of 41, that I had to get the aircraft modified and also get the crews that were coming from the training school, from the OTUs. So I got the first aircraft and the first crew, and we took it to Sealand, RAF Sealand, to be modified, which took 2 or 3 months. During this time, the Air Ministry introduced me to a Flight Lieutenant Eric Kraus, K-R-A-U-S, who had been a pre-war European skiing champion. He was Norwegian and had been a professor of meteorology in Bergen University. Anyway, Eric had been given the task of organising these Met flights. Met flights had already started before the war. There were short-range Met flights which simply did vertical ascents over the airfield. And then the first long-range Met flight was at Bertram Newton with Blenheims flying out over the North Sea.
Now, what was Kraus actually? That was
Flight Lieutenant Eric Kraus. Yes.
And what was he actually doing then?
He was the hands-on man giving me advice as to how to form and operate the Met flight and what the navigators should do. Incidentally, for the first time, we were now getting navigators, so that the crew of the Hudson was a pilot and a navigator and two wireless operators. Of course, there was no air gunner, but we had the wireless operators because all the information that we obtained en route had to be coded and transmitted back to base whilst we were in the course of the mission. Eric Kraus was a very interesting character, very much hands-on. He had himself flown very many missions with the Blenheims from Bertram doing the Met Observer's navigation work. In fact, he didn't have any wings, he didn't have any brevet, and on one occasion he was told that he couldn't carry on acting as a navigator unless he had qualified as an alligator. So to satisfy the authorities, he went and sat the examination for navigators. And he failed the examination on meteorology, because one of the questions asked actually posed an impossible set of circumstances, and so instead of answering the question, he simply pointed out the impossibility of the circumstances, and as a result, was failed his exam. Nevertheless, he put his brevet up and flew as navigator. Whilst the aircraft were being modified, I went with Eric Krauss to the Met flight at Aldergrove, which had already got going with Hudson's, to get some better first-hand briefing from Aldergrove. And whilst we were there, Eric expressed a desire to go up to Iceland to see what the situation was, and also to get the opportunity of doing some skiing. So we flew up in early December 41 and spent a couple of days at Calvadanes whilst Eric went skiing at the ski club. On the morning of the 7th of December, we returned from Calvadanes to Aldergrove. And at that time of the year, of course, it was more or less dark the whole time in Iceland. As we were climbing above cloud, just as we were breaking cloud, and the rising sun was in front, a big red sun directly in front, my wireless operator passed a note to me to say that he just tuned into the BBC and picked up the news of Pearl Harbor, most propitious with this rising sun in front of my eyes. I'll never forget it.
Now, tell me how your flight worked then. You had three aircraft.
Yes, we flew one sortie a day on a route, on a track that was given to us. It varied from time to time by the Met people. And the time of takeoff was usually very early in the morning, because the information was required in time for the Air Ministry weather forecasters to use it in order to get weather briefing for the bomber activities that night. There is published now a book by a Met observer called Even the Birds Were Walking, which is a bit of a line, but we certainly did fly under conditions that prevented the operational squadrons from flying.
What type of conditions?
I beg your
pardon? In what way?
Well, with very low cloud and bad visibility, and maybe gale, crosswind gale conditions. In fact, really, they were at times extremely risky. And of course, returning to base in similar bad weather conditions, because in Iceland we had no diversionary airfield. Well, there was Calvadanes, but if the weather was no good at Reykjavik, it would be no good at Calvadanes as well. And the only emergency landing was on a beach in the east of Iceland. On one occasion, coming back from a Met flight, it was my normal routine to let down and get the sea in sight an hour before ETA at Reykjavik. And on one occasion I was letting down an hour before ETA and broke cloud at something like 10,000 feet over an 8,000 foot mountain 200 miles away from my dead reckoning position. If the cloud base had been any lower, we would have just flown into the mountain.
So it's just a